Welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. It's our 100th edition today, and in celebration of that, we've invited a literary superstar into the studio. He's been an international athlete, a politician, he's served time in prison, he's a member of the House of Lords, and he's one of the best-selling writers in the world. He's published in 97 countries and more than 33 languages. His books have sold over 330 million copies worldwide. 40 years after his first bestseller, he's still consistently hitting the number one spot. And with a new book out, it's likely to happen again. Geoffrey Archer, welcome.
Thank you, Jordan. It's good to be back.
Well, this is the second time we've spoken.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The last time we caught up was in Dubai at the Emirates Lit Fest. And at that time, you told us that your mother was a great reader and your biggest influence. Do you remember the first book that you read?
She was very keen on Swallows and Amazons. I remember she introduced me to Swallows and Amazons at a young age. And then the Just William books. She loved the Just William books. Don't suppose anybody reads them nowadays, or maybe do.
I think on audio, a lot of people listen to them.
Yeah. Do they? She loved the Just William books. Then we moved on to Charles Dickens, who she thought was the greatest of them all. And after that, she let me get on my own. She let me head off in my own direction.
Now, your father was in his 60s when you were born. Tell me a little about him.
He was a printer in Weston-super-Mare, and I don't think he was that interested in books. It was my mother who wanted to be a writer. She was a journalist in Weston-super-Mare on the local paper called The Mercury. She wanted to be the writer, but it didn't influence me in any way. I didn't get to be a writer until I was 34 years old. I wanted to be other things before that.
Mm. Well, of course, because you had a variety of jobs. You also worked as a PE teacher, and in fact, you've got a pretty athletic background, I mean, including representing England.
Yes, I loved, before going up to Oxford, being involved in sport, and my number one sport at the time, I'd love to have been a cricketer, I just wasn't good enough. My number one sport at the time was athletics, and I ran for Great Britain and for England, but I was never good enough, frankly. There was a half a dozen people who were in a different class, I just couldn't catch them.
But you had an Oxford Blue.
And ran for Britain, yeah.
So, and it was while you were at Oxford, it seemed a very exciting time. You even had a brush with the Beatles.
Well, we were doing the 21st anniversary of Oxfam, and we managed to get the Beatles to come and launch the 21st anniversary of Oxfam, which was very thrilling. I don't think, to be honest, I knew how important they were at the time. Mm. I now realise years later, I think you do things sometimes as a child without realising how big it is. I'm not sure I'd have the nerve to do it nowadays.
Yeah. You were 29 when you were elected an MP. Where did that desire for a political role come from?
Oxford, I think. I felt with politics you can never, never, never complete what you want to achieve. It's always driving you every single day to do more and achieve more. And for me, at that time, I just thought politics offered me all that, all the energy and determination could be taken out on politics, which is probably why, in a way, it's the most exciting profession in the world. But at the same time, nowadays, it's one of the toughest.
Mm, and we'll come on to the current government. Your first spell in Parliament, you stood up for some things way beyond your time, in fact. I mean, at that time, you were advocating for free television licences for elderly people. You were against museum entrance charging, also voting against restoring capital punishment. I mean, all things that are hot-button issues now.
Well, I felt very strongly about them at the time. I think the trouble with issues is that you fight for them, and then 20 years later, they're just part of the fabric, which is good. Mm. For example, I fought for the primogeniture bill. That was my bill. I brought it into the House of Lords. So I don't think you think you're ahead of your time at the time. You just think it's the right thing to do. And I would remind you, if you're old enough, that I was at the time of Screaming Lord Such. And Screaming Lord Such declared 12 manifesto things, and 6 of them are now the law of this country. And he was laughed at. Anthony Wedgwood Benn was regularly laughed at. And many of the things he said would happen have happened.
Mm. During all of this time, you're in Parliament, of course, running various businesses, and then you had a financial crisis.
Yeah.
Tell us what happened.
Well, I very foolishly invested on the advice of the vice president of the Bank of Boston in London. How stupid of me. If I'd done it nowadays, I'd have got my money back because they wouldn't have dared face the publicity of advising someone and finding it was fraudulent. In those days, they got away with it. So I lost my job. I had to leave the House of Commons, sat down and wrote my first book, Not a Penny More, Not a Penny Less, which sold the momentous 3,000 copies and made £3,000. So I was living off my wife for a long time. She was then a don at Cambridge. She'd moved from Oxford to Cambridge, teaching chemistry at Newnham College, Cambridge. And Trinity, because she taught her dual fellowship, gave her a lovely flat to live in. So at least we had somewhere to live. And I lived off her for 7 years until Cain and Abel. And Cain and Abel changed everything overnight.
Absolutely. That first book, when it came out, was it written specifically to get you out of the financial soup? Or had you felt this driving need to put pen to paper?
You can't start a literary career to get yourself out of financial troubles. A very, very, very few authors make money. Most of them have a day job and are writing books for a love and hoping they'll have a breakthrough. I was so stupid, I knew nothing about the publishing world or books and assumed that if I write a book, people want to read it, which was very stupid of me. But Cain and Abel, they did. 1 million people bought it in the first week. It's had its 100th edition this year, sold 32 million copies. And I've tried to, when people ask, well, why do you think? I haven't a clue. It just happened and it changed my whole life.
Well, it is extraordinary, though, isn't it, that some books just do.
Yeah. It's sometimes unexplainable. You read the book yourself because there's always a strange book every year that has a breakthrough. And often when I read it, I think, why? Sometimes I get it straight away, but sometimes I think, why? People do like storytellers.
That, of course, because you were now solvent again, you were writing, and you were able to return to politics.
Yes, Margaret Thatcher invited me to join as Conservative Party deputy chairman. And I worked with her for 11 years, which was a great privilege, not always in government because she sadly came out of government. And I stayed working with her. And an amazing experience that was, and an amazing privilege.
Well, we're speaking in the week when the Conservative Party seems to be in utter crisis. Michael Fallon, the Defence Secretary, has just resigned. And I wonder what your take on this is.
Don't have a take in the sense that I've been out of politics for 20 years. I have an interest in the sense I look very carefully from the outside, both at the United States and indeed Spain has been fascinating for me this week because I have a home in Mallorca. So I don't have that hands-on because I'm 77, so I watch from the outside. In the case of Michael Fallon, he's a friend. I like and admire him. I thought he was a good Secretary of State, liked by the forces and by politicians, and I think it's very sad.
You use the phrase hands-on, which of course very apt in this kind of, as it's been dubbed, Sexminster scandal. But do you think this is about, is this a generational thing? We have moved on and behaviour that was acceptable back then, perhaps when you were in Parliament, is no longer something that people will let go?
I think there's a bit of that. I think, yes, it is true that there was a different culture and a different attitude, which is now quite rightly totally unacceptable. And therefore one feels sorry, not for the extreme cases, of course not, but if it was just touching a girl's knee once, it does seem rather a lot 15 years later to be giving up being Secretary of State for Defence.
Yeah, absolutely.
If, and particularly as the person affected has said very clearly, she can't understand what the fuss is about.
Mm. Geoffrey, do you think that Mrs May's government can last?
Oh, yes. If the word last means survive, yes, I do. Not easy times. That could change a lot if there were, say, 3 resignations next week. That would take a lot. But this one resignation, no, that won't bring the government down.
3 resignations don't seem quite so far-fetched now, though, looking at the current climate. And if that happens, if the government falls, does it go to Labour?
Oh, yes, Labour would win if we had an election today. Nothing clever in saying that just because I'm work for the Conservative Party. Nothing clever in that. I'm rather tired of people saying, God, he's saying the Labour could win, as if it's a big shock. Do we imagine if we had an election next week, the Conservatives would win it? No, they wouldn't. 2 years' time could be very different.
Mm. And a Jeremy Corbyn-led government, how would that be?
silence prevails.
Moving on with your own political career, you were involved with the Kurdish cause.
Yes. John Major was prime minister. He asked me to go out there. The first thing he did as prime minister was create the no-fly zone so that Saddam Hussein couldn't attack the Kurds. And he then sent me out to address parliament, which I did, gave me a speech, and I addressed it in their parliament on his behalf, which is why he's so popular in Kurdistan. They love him in Kurdistan. And got to know the Kurdish people and like the Kurdish people and have followed their history ever since.
Mm. Of course, Barzani has just resigned and the whole Kurdish independence movement looks like it's just fragmenting after their referendum. It's now, they seem further away from it than ever.
Well, it's not just Barzani's resignation, which I haven't got to the bottom of yet. Talabani died a couple of weeks ago. So the two people who had fought for an independent Kurdistan for all these years, one dies and the other resigns, all within a few days of each other. The place will be in a mess because Barzani and Talabani were world-class leaders. They'd have been leaders in any country they'd been born in. They were very remarkable people. I know Mr. Barzani and President Barzani very well indeed, and I knew President Talabani. I promise you, if they'd been in England, they'd have been trying to be prime minister. They were class people.
So, I mean, the Kurds, they're the biggest nation without
a
state.
They're the biggest nation on earth in population that don't have their own country.
What do you think will happen?
Oh, I didn't know the answer 20 years ago, and I certainly don't know the answer now. It's a mess.
You were selected by the Conservative Party as candidate for the London mayoral election of 2000. Tremendously exciting. You had to withdraw, and we'll come to that. But I just wondered about Sadiq Khan, who, of course, is Labour Party. You were Conservative. But if you had to give him a report card now?
I think he's doing very well. He's very convincing. There is absolutely no question that he has a passion and love of London. He's clearly a very bright guy. I think he's doing a very good job.
And if you were in charge right now, is there anything in particular you would...
Well, it's an interesting question because I'm not in charge right now, and therefore it isn't my day-to-day thinking. I'm fascinated by writing. I'm fascinated by the world I'm in. I'm currently got a book out of short stories. So people quite often ask me questions and they assume that I'm still absolutely fascinated, would want to be mayor tomorrow, would want to change things. No, I don't.
Mm. Quite happy writing, no political aspiration.
I'm having a wonderful time. Mm. I'm 77. Let me have a rest, please.
If we could just look briefly at your trial and the prison sentence. I mean, going into that must have been a horrible shock to the system, a complete change of gear. Yet it didn't knock your writing.
I wrote three books on while I was in prison, and... surprisingly, I don't understand why they're still selling.
One of the things that your prison term inspired was a book of short stories in Cat and Nine Tails. Mm. A lot of those stories actually came...
Actually, yes, quite right.
From that prison time. So in terms of writing short stories, because I know, of course, you've written for theatre, you've written for many different mediums, the short story shift, is that a difficult one to make?
Well, the big difference... In a short story, in a novel, I literally start off, if I'm blooming lucky, if I know four or five pages in a row. With a short story, you've got to know the beginning, the middle, and the end. You can't write a short story and not know the end.
Mm.
If you don't know the end, you'll be get to page 30 and where's this going? It's not going anywhere. Well, why did I write the... You've got to know where you're going. With a novel, you haven't.
And you can work it out as you go along.
If the gods are very kind, yes, you shoot off in different directions and you do other things, yeah, if the gods are very kind.
Well, in fact, I mean, last time we spoke, you talked about writing as being a God-given gift. And I wonder if your storytelling, if that gift has evolved over time.
Ah, you can become a better craftsman. If you read Scott Fitzgerald's notebooks, there's no doubt that he felt that he became a better craftsman. But he said of the storytelling side, that doesn't change in his view. And in fact, there are some people who would still tell you that Not a Penny More, Not a Penny Less is the best thing I've ever done. That's 40 years ago.
And your first book. Yeah.
And the third book, Cain and Abel, has never been surpassed in numbers. So I have a tendency to think Mr. Scott Fitzgerald was correct, that you can become a better craftsman, but the storytelling is a gift.
Do you think there's been a shift towards short storytelling more? Perhaps, I know there are various awards. The Sunday Times are very strong on short stories, for instance. But for a long time, they were sort of languishing in the wilderness, rather. People didn't tend to read them.
Oh, a very long time. When I was a child, I would read H.H. Munro, Saki, Maupassant, O. Henry, Somerset Maugham, Roald Dahl. And they wrote short stories, and everybody except they wrote short stories. Scott Fitzgerald did as well, of course. Now, there are not a group of people who write short stories. I'm one of the few people who enjoys doing both novels and short stories.
Do you find one easier than the other?
Oh, no. In the sense that, of course, a novel is harder work. Of course, a novel can take 1,000 hours, whereas a short story can be done in 20 hours. Mm. But with a short story, if you get it wrong, everybody sees you getting it wrong. You've got to have that twist. You've got to have that turn. Mm. You've got to keep them gripped. And you've got to shock them at the end.
You mentioned hours, and of course you're well known for having a very rigid writing practice, which is very definitely formed in chunks of hours. Just to tell me about that process.
Well, I think it comes from the athletics days. I think it comes from the discipline of athletics. But I rise about 5:30 in the morning. I write 6 to 8. 2-hour break, 10 to 12. 2-hour break, 2 to 4. 2-hour break, 6 to 8. And I like that. That suits me. I can't do more than 2 hours. I lose my concentration after 2 hours. But I want to get back to it after a 2-hour break. Mm. So 8 hours a day. Probably the first draft of a novel will be 300 or 400 hours. 6 weeks. 5-6 weeks. But what I hand in to the publishers will possibly be the 13th, 14th, 15th draft. 1,000 hours. A lot of young people come to see me and they say, I want to be a writer, Geoffrey. And I say to them, go to the ballet. And they say, what do you mean, go to the ballet? I say, go to the ballet. I want you to sit in the front row at Covent Garden. I want you to see the prima ballerina. And I want you to watch her. And I want you to imagine how many hours she has done to be the prima ballerina. Then I want you to watch the chorus line at the back. And I want you to think how many hours they have spent to be the chorus line. Then I want you to think about all the thousands of ballet dancers who would love to be on that stage in the chorus. Then you'll know what I go through every single time.
Yeah.
And if you're not willing to do that, don't even join in, because I'm up against the prima ballerina and so are you.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of the fact that you do so many drafts, I mean, when we spoke before, you said that your editor really just lightly guides, doesn't make any sweeping changes. And is that because you've already been through it 15 times
yourself? I think there's a bit of truth in that if I showed her the first draft, her notes would be longer. But she has a tendency to, a very fine editor she is, has a tendency to discuss whether a character should be developed or another one dropped, or should the story go in this direction or that direction. Because by the time she gets it, it's pretty well the finished work. But that doesn't stop. You need an outsider to look at your work. If you're a ballet dancer or an opera singer or a violin player, you need an outsider to look at your work and say, have you thought of this? And so often you haven't, because you've lived with it so long. It's been so close to you. The only advice I would give to anybody still listening, don't shirt your husband or wife. They will not tell you the truth. They are not going to tell you it's the biggest load of rubbish they've ever read. Sadly, husbands and wives are a disaster because they then come to me and say, my husband says this is the best thing. And I think, oh, not again, please. So my advice always is to someone who's written a book, find a friend who you trust. Get them to show it to someone you've never met or heard of. Get them to write one page on what they think of your book. You'll get an honest answer.
That's such wise advice. So does Mary not? She's not your first
reader. She doesn't know. But partly Mary isn't, because she's a scientist. She's a pure scientist in every sense. So a novel for her is not natural reading. You will not find a novel by the side of her bed, unless it's Proust. So no, she gets it last. She is the last person to read it. It's usually in print form by the time Mary gets it.
Mm. And would you find a novel by the side of your bed? And would you find it there while you were in the midst of writing a book?
That's two questions. The first is you'll always find me reading a novel. I'm reading P.D. James at the moment, The Six Monstrous Murders, and enjoying it immensely. But while I'm writing, no, I don't read I read the newspapers. I might read non-fiction for research, but no, I won't touch a novel while I'm writing.
And do you write in silence? Or with music or any
No music.
Kind of...
No. Little room overlooking the sea, so I can hear seagulls. I never mind natural sounds. I can hear the sea. I can hear seagulls. What I hate is aeroplanes, trains, noise, people. So I get away from them completely. And I rather admire people who can write in, doesn't matter how much noise is around them. I don't know how they do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's come to this latest book, which I've enjoyed tremendously. It's called Telltale, and it's published by Macmillan. It is a collection of short stories. And at the very beginning, you say that some of these stories are loosely based on incidents that you've picked up on your travels. Mm. And I found that so interesting, looking at the starred stories that are, in fact, based on things that you've heard of or that has happened to you. So, for instance, one of the stories that really struck me was a story set against the First World War, A Good Toss to Lose. Mm. A terribly sad story.
True story. Young German teaching at rugby school was sent back to Germany because war was approaching. And one of the boys he taught, they actually met on the battlefield. And they could have killed each other or one could have killed the other. So they tossed the coin to decide which one of them would be captured and which one of them would be... taking him back, and A Good Toss to Lose is a very apt title. Mm. It's a very sad story. 80% of it's true. Of course, an author embellishes. Of course, an author goes in another direction. Of course, an author adds something. But the basic truth of that story is that those two men, one who'd been a schoolmaster and one the schoolboy, met on the battlefield at Ypres.
And there's a tremendously moving postscript to that story.
Well, that I did invent. That I would have to admit is not true, and I'm delighted that you feel it's moving, because I wrote it and then showed it to my wife, who'd introduced me to the original story. First time she's ever introduced me to a story. But she met the German. Because of her scientific work, she met a German who knew the story, and the German told her, and she told me. And she said, I said, do you think this is, you know, how do you feel about adding this at the end? And she was fine on it. It was my comment about two world wars. Mm. I'm writing the first story as my comment on the First World War. The back page is my comment on the Second World War. War is so completely and utterly pointless.
Isn't it? In the story Holiday of a Lifetime, again, based on a true story, you do a really interesting thing with the ending, because you give us three different alternative endings.
Well, my problem was I had three different alternatives. So when I got to the end of the story, which I got from a leading insurance broker in London who had insured the Twin Towers. I mean, we're talking about a... And he told me a story. I said, no, that's too big. No, I'm not going to write that. Give me some more. So he told me another big story with aeroplanes. And I went, no. And he suddenly told me this story about this wicked old woman who was stealing on average £5,000 to £10,000 a time from the biggest insurance companies in the world. I just thought it was a wonderful story. But when I got to the end, I suddenly realized I got three endings. So I wrote all three, and then the publisher saw it and said, let's publish all three. Let the public decide which one they like.
I love that idea. Absolutely love the idea. I think, but maybe in the future we'll see a sort of DIY publishing industry where people can sort of submit online what they ought to, what they think how stories ought to be.
Well, we all do that. I mean, whenever I read someone else's book, no, not whenever. Quite often I feel, no, I'd have changed that ending. I'd have done it differently. Mm. And I wonder if it's me just because that's my profession and that's what I do.
And of course, as you say, you travel all over the world and you're collecting these stories. Are you doing it consciously? Are you saying to people, tell me your best story?
If I meet, for example, the insurance man, the Lord Mayor of London, I'd done an auction for her, Fiona Wolfe, and she invited Mary and myself to dinner with a small group of people to say thank you, which was very kind of her. And she sat me next to this leading insurance broker. And the answer to your question is, I said, I knew I'd only got 1 hour with him. I'd never see him again in my life. So I said, give me a story. And he said, what do you mean, give you a story? I said, come on, yours is a profession where amazing things are happening. And in your lifetime, because you're the top of it, you will have seen some amazing things that you've never been able to write. Tell me. And he told me two or three, which I said were the big ones, the 9/11 and that sort of thing. But they wouldn't have worked for me. And then he said it came across my desk that this little old lady had been stealing money from us. And it would never have reached me if it hadn't linked into something else. And then I saw it and realized she'd been up to it for several years. So I got him to tell me that story. Of course, that's a real story. That's a wonderful story. That's a human story.
And it is. It's those little human interactions and the human foibles that make your work so interesting.
Yeah, that's very kind.
You seem to have a wonderful insight into how people work.
Well, I've had a fascinating life. I've met fascinating people. I've done fascinating things. And I love people. I remember once being told in the street at Bristol when I was doing canvassing by, frankly, an aristocrat who was a very good politician, but not wonderful on the street. And he said, "My God, Geoffrey, you really like these people, don't you?" And I do. The truth is, I love people. And that's probably why they tell me stories.
Is there a favourite story in this new book, Telltale?
No. Who Killed the Mayor is getting a lot of people talking about that. But the one the girls are talking about all the time is A Wasted Hour. I turned down A Wasted Hour 20 years ago when this girl gave it to me. She said, "I've got this amazing story," and she told it, and I said, "Thank you very much," and went home and forgot it. Then remembered it again and told it to a friend of mine, a male friend of mine, and he said, "That's an amazing story, Geoffrey." So I wrote it, and it got into the 14 stories, and I still thought, well, it's all right, isn't it? And then the women started writing, saying, "Oh, I love A Wasted Hour. A Wasted Hour is so moving," which is the story of a girl who got in a car with an older man when she was thumbing lifts, and what happened in the next hour, she never got over with the rest of her life.
I think it is a lovely, lovely story, and this is a lovely, lovely book.
That's very kind.
Thank you so much for coming in to tell us about it. On the week of publication, it's called Telltale, and it's published by Macmillan. Geoffrey Archer, thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers with me, Georgina Godwin, and thanks very much to the team of George McDonough and Helena Juriet. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. Thank you for listening.